oil stew. There was Ajwa, then Sarah, the half-caste wench of Sam York. There was also the new wench, Ekoa. She was tall and slender, and she walked as though her limbs were made of thin twigs, as though wind could snap and collapse her. This day, Ekoa was lying in the slim shade of a palm tree. Ephea had helped her coil her hair the day before, and in the sun, it looked like a million tiny snakes rising from her head. "My husband cannot pronounce my name well. He wants to call me Emily," Ekoa said. "If he wants to call you Emily, let him call you Emily," Ajwa said. Out of the four of them, she had been a wench the longest, and she always spoke her opinions loudly and freely. Everyone knew that her husband practically worshipped at her feet. Better that than to listen to him butcher your mother tongue over and over. Sarah dug her elbows into the dust. "My father was a soldier, too. When he died, Mama moved us back to our village. I came to marry Sam, but he did not have to worry about my name. Do you know he knew my father? They were soldiers together in the castle when I was just a small girl." Ephea shook her head. She was lying on her belly. She loved days like this one, where she could speak Fanti as fast as she wanted. No one asking her to slow down. No one telling her to speak English. "My husband comes up from the dungeons, stinking like a dying animal," Ekoa said softly. They all looked away. No one ever mentioned the dungeons. "He comes to me, smelling like feces and rot, and looking at me like he has seen a million ghosts. And he cannot tell if I am one of them or not. I tell him he must wash before he touches me, and sometimes he does. But sometimes he pushes me to the floor and pushes into me like he has been possessed." Ephea sat up and rested a hand against her stomach. James had received another letter from his wife the day after he'd found the root underneath their bed. They had not slept together since. The wind picked up. The snakes in Ekoa's hair snapped this way and that. Her twig arms lifted. "There are people down there, you know," she said. "There are women down there who look like us, and our husbands must learn to tell the difference." They all fell silent. Ekoa leaned back against the tree, and Ephea watched as a line of ants passed over a strand of her hair, the shape of it seeming to them to be just another part of the natural world. After that first day in the castle, James never spoke to Ephea about the slaves they kept in their dungeon, but he spoke to her often about beasts. That was what the Ashantis trafficked most here. Beasts. Monkeys and chimpanzees, even a few leopards. Birds like the king crowns and parrots that she and Fifi used to try to catch when they were children, roaming the forest in search of the one odd bird. The bird that had feathers so beautiful, it seemed to be set apart from the rest. They would spend hours on end looking for just one such bird, and most days they would find none. She wondered what such a bird would be worth, because in the castle all beasts were ascribed worth. She had seen James look at a king crown brought in by one of the Ashanti traders and declare that it was worth 4 pounds. What about the human beast? How much was he worth? Ephea had known, of course, that there were people in the dungeons. People who spoke a different dialect than her. People who had been captured in tribal wars. Even people who had been stolen. But she had never thought of where they went from there. She had never thought of what James must think every time he saw them. If he went into the dungeons and saw women who reminded him of her, who looked like her, and smelled like her. If he came back to her haunted by what he saw. Effia soon realized that she was pregnant. It was spring, and the mango trees outside the castle had started to drop down mangoes. Her stomach jutted out, soft and fleshy, its own kind of fruit. James was so happy when she told him that he picked her up and danced her around their quarters. She slapped his back and told him to set her down, lest they shake the baby to pieces. And he had complied before bending and planting a kiss on her barely bulged stomach. But their joy was soon tempered by news from her village. Kobe had fallen ill. So ill that it was unclear whether or not he would still be alive by the time Effia made the journey back to see him. She was not sure who had sent the letter from her village, for it was addressed to her husband and written in broken English. She had been gone 2 years, and she had not heard from anyone in her family since then. She knew that this was Baba's doing, and indeed she was surprised that anyone had even thought to notify her of her father's illness. The journey back to the village took about 3 days. James did not want her to make the trip alone in her condition, but he could not accompany her, so he sent along a housegirl. When they arrived, everything in the village looked different. The colors of the treetop canopy seemed to have dulled, their vibrant browns and greens now muted. The sounds seemed different, too. Everything that once rustled now stood still. Abeku had made the village into one so prosperous that they would forever be known as one of the leading slave markets in all of the Gold Coast. He had no time to see Effia, but he sent along gifts of sweet palm wine and gold to meet her once she arrived at her father's compound. Baba stood in the entranceway. She looked to have aged 100 years in the 2 that Effia had been gone. Her scowl was held in place by the hundreds of tiny wrinkles that pulled at her skin, and her nails had grown so long that they curled like talons. She didn't speak a word, only led Effia to the room where her father lay dying. No one knew what sickness had struck Kobe. Apothecaries, witch doctors, even the Christian minister from the castle had been called upon to give their opinions and pray over the man, and yet no measure of healing thoughts or medicines could spit him out of the lips of death. Fifi stood beside him, wiping the sweat off his forehead carefully. Suddenly, Effia was crying and shaking. She reached out her hand to her father's and began to stroke the sallow skin there. "He cannot speak," Fifi whispered, glancing quickly at her bulging belly. "He is too weak." She nodded and continued to cry. Fifi dropped the drenched cloth and took Effia's hand. "Big sister, I am the one who wrote you the letter. Mama did not want you to come, but I thought you should get to see our father before he enters Asamando." Kobe closed his eyes, and a low murmur escaped his lips so that Effia could see that the land of the spirits was indeed calling him. "Thank you," she said to Fifi, and he nodded. He began walking out of the room, but before he reached the hut's door, he turned. "She is not your mother, you know, Baba. Our father had you by a housegirl who ran away into the fire the night you were born. She is the one who left you that stone you wear around your neck." Fifi stepped outside, and soon Kobe died, Effia still holding his hand. The villagers would say that Kobe had been waiting for Effia to come home before he could die. But Effia knew that it was more complex than that. His unrest had kept him alive, and now that unrest belonged to Effia. It would feed her life and the life of a child. After she had wiped her tears, Ifeah walked out of the compound and into the sun. Baba sat on the stump of a felled tree, her shoulders squared as she held hands with Fifi, who stood beside her, now as quiet as a field mouse. Ifeah wanted to say something to Baba, to apologize perhaps for the burden her father had made Baba carry all of those years. But before she could speak, Baba hacked from her throat, spit on the ground before Ifeah's feet, and said, "You are nothing, from nowhere. No mother, and now no father." She looked at Ifeah's stomach and smiled. "What can grow from nothing?" Essie. The smell was unbearable. In the corner, a woman was crying so hard that it seemed her bones would break from her convulsions. This was what they wanted. The baby had messed itself, and Afua, its mother, had no milk. She was naked, save for the small scrap of fabric the traders had given her to wipe her nipples when they leaked. But they had miscalculated. No food for mother meant no food for baby. The baby would cry soon, but the sound would be absorbed by the mud walls, subsumed into the cries of the hundreds of women who surrounded it. Essie had been in the woman's dungeon of the Cape Coast Castle for 2 weeks. She spent her 15th birthday there. On her 14th birthday, she was in the heart of Ashantiland, in her father's big man's compound. He was the best warrior in the village, so everyone had come to pay their respects to the daughter who grew more beautiful with each passing day. Kwasi Enero brought 60 yams, more yams than any other suitor had ever brought before. Essie would have married him in the summer when the sun stretched long and high, when the palm trees could be tapped for wine, climbed by the spryest children, their arms holding the trunk in a hug as they shinnied to the top to pluck the fruits that waited there. When she wanted to forget the castle, she thought of these things, but she did not expect joy. Hell was a place of remembering. Each beautiful moment passed through the mind's eye until it fell to the ground like a rotten mango, perfectly useless. Uselessly perfect. A soldier came into the dungeon and began to speak. He had to hold his nose to keep from vomiting. The women did not understand him. His voice didn't seem angry, but they had learned to back away at the sight of that uniform, that skin the color of coconut meat. The soldier repeated himself, louder this time, as though volume would coax understanding. Irritated, he ventured further into the room. He stepped in feces and cursed. He plucked the baby from Afua's cradled arms, and Afua began to cry. He slapped her, and she stopped, a learned reflex. Tansi sat next to Essie. The two had made the journey to the castle together. Now that they weren't walking constantly, or speaking in hushed tones, Essie had time to get to know her journey friend. Tansi was a hardy and ugly woman, barely turned 16. She was thick, her body built on a solid foundation. Essie hoped, and dared not hope, that they would be allowed to stay together even longer. "Where are they taking the baby?" Essie asked. Tansi spit onto the clay floor and swirled the spittle with her finger, creating a salve. "They will kill it, I'm sure," she said. The baby was conceived before Afua's marriage ceremony. As punishment, the village chief had sold her to the traders. Afua had told Essie this when she first came into the dungeon, when she was still certain that a mistake had been made, that her parents would return for her. Now, hearing Tansi speak, Afua resumed her crying, but it was as though no one heard. These tears were a matter of routine. They came for all of the women. They dropped until the clay below them turned to mud. At night, Essie dreamed that if they all cried in unison, the mud would turn to river, and they could be washed away into the Atlantic. Tansi, tell me a story, please, Essie begged. But then they were interrupted again. The soldiers came in with the same mushy porridge that had been fed to them in the Fanti village where Essie was held. Essie had learned to swallow it down without gagging. It was the only food they ever received, and their stomachs were empty more days than full. The porridge passed right through her, it seemed. The ground was littered with their waste. The unbearable smell. "Ah, you're too old for stories, my sister," Tansi said once the soldiers left. But Essie knew she would give in soon. Tansi enjoyed the sound of her own voice. She pulled Essie's head into her lap and began playing with her hair, pulling at the strands that had been caked with dust. So brittle that they could be broken, each one snapped like a twig. "Do you know the story of the Kente cloth?" Tansi asked. Essie had heard it numerous times before, twice from Tansi herself, but she shook her head. Asking if the story had been heard before was a part of the story itself. Tansi began to tell her. Two Ashanti men went out into the forest one day. They were weavers by trade, and they had gone out to hunt for meat. When they got to the forest to collect their traps, they were met by Anansi, the mischievous spider. He was spinning a magnificent web. They watched him, studied him, and soon realized that a spider's web is a unique and beautiful thing, and that a spider's technique is flawless. They went home and decided to weave cloth the way Anansi weaves his web. From that, Kente was born. "You are a fine storyteller," Essie said. Tansi laughed and smoothed the salve she had created onto her knees and elbows to soothe the cracked skin there. The last story she had told Essie was of how she had been captured by the Northerners, plucked from her marriage bed while her husband was off fighting a war. She had been taken with a few other girls, but the rest had not survived. By morning, Afua had died. Her skin was purple and blue, and Essie knew that she had held her breath until Inyami took her. They would all be punished for this. The soldiers came in, though Essie was no longer able to tell what time. The mud walls of the dungeon made all time equal. There was no sunlight. Darkness was day and night, and everything in between. Sometimes there were so many bodies stacked into the women's dungeon that they all had to lie stomach down so that women could be stacked on top of them. It was one of those days. Essie was kicked to the ground by one of the soldiers, his foot at the base of her neck so that she couldn't turn her head to breathe anything but the dust and detritus from the ground. The new women were brought in, and some were wailing so hard that the soldiers smacked them unconscious. They were piled on top of the other women, their bodies dead weight. When the smacked ones came to, there were no more tears. Essie could feel the woman on top of her peeing. Urine traveled between both of their legs. Essie learned to split her life into before the castle and now. Before the castle, she was the daughter of Big Man and his third wife, Mame. Now, she was dust. Before the castle, she was the prettiest girl in the village. Now, she was thin air. Essie was born in a small village in the heart of the Ashanti nation. Big Man had thrown an outdooring feast that lasted 4 nights. 5 goats were slaughtered and boiled until their tough skins turned tender. It was rumored that Mame did not stop crying or praising Inyame for the entire duration of the ceremony, nor would she set baby Essie down. "You never know what could happen," she kept repeating. At that time, Big Man was known only as Kwame Asare. Essie's father was not a chief, but he commanded just as much respect, for he was the best warrior the Ashanti nation had ever seen. And at age 25, he already had 5 wives and 10 children. Everyone in the village knew his seed was strong. His sons, still toddlers and young children, were already tough wrestlers, and his daughters were beauties. Essie grew up in bliss. The villagers called her Ripe Mango because she was just on the right side of spoiled, stale sweet. There was nothing her parents would refuse her. Even her strong warrior of a father had been known to carry her through the village at night when she couldn't sleep. Essie would hold the tip of his finger, to her as thick as a branch, as she toddled past the huts that made up each compound. Her village was small, but growing steadily. In the first year of their walks, it wouldn't take but 20 minutes to reach the forest edge that cut them off from the rest of Ashanti land. But that forest had been pushed farther and farther back, until by the 5th year, the journey there took nearly an hour. Essie loved walking to the forest with her father. She would listen enraptured, as he told her how the forest was so dense it was like a shield, impenetrable to their enemies. He would tell her how he and the other warriors knew the forest better than they knew the lines of their own palms. And this was good. Following the lines of a palm would lead nowhere, but the forest led the warriors to other villages that they could conquer to build up their strength. "When you are old enough, Essie, you will learn how to climb these trees with nothing but your bare hands," he said to her as they walked back to the village one day. Essie looked up. The tops of the trees looked as though they were brushing the sky, and Essie wondered why leaves were green instead of blue. When Essie was 7 years old, her father won the battle that would earn him the name Big Man. There had been rumors that in a village just north of theirs, warriors had come back with splendors of gold and women. They had even raided the British storehouse, earning gunpowder and muskets in the process. Chief Inuro, the leader of Essie's village, called a meeting of all the able-bodied men. "Have you heard the news?" he asked them, and they grunted, slammed their staffs against the hard earth, and cried out, "The swine of the northern village are walking about like kings. All around, Ashanti people will say, 'It is the northerners who stole guns from the British. It is the northerners who are the most powerful warriors in all of the Gold Coast.'" The men stomped their feet and shook their heads. "Will we allow this?" the chief asked. "No!" they cried. Kwaku Ajay, the most sensible among them, hushed their cries and said, "Listen to us. We may go to fight the northerners, but what have we? No guns, no gunpowder. And what will we gain? So many people will praise our enemies in the north, but will they not still praise us as well? We have been the strongest village for decades. No one has been able to break through the forest and challenge us. So, will you have us wait until the northern snake slithers its way into our fields and steals our women?" Essie's father asked. The 2 men stood on opposite sides of the room, and all the other men stood between them, turning their heads from one to the other in order to see which gift would win, wisdom or strength. I only say, let us not be too hasty, lest we appear weak in the process. But who is weak? Essie's father asked. He pointed to Nana Ade, then Kojo Enyako, then Kwabena Jima. Who among us is weak? You? Or maybe you? The men shook their heads one by one, and soon they were all shaking their entire bodies into a rallying cry that could be heard throughout the village. From the compound where Essie stood helping her mother fry plantains, she heard them, and dropped two slices of plantain so quickly that oil jumped up and splashed her mother's leg.
Aye!
Her mother cried out, wiping the oil away with her hands and blowing on the burn.
Stupid girl!
When will you learn to be careful around fire? Mame asked. Essie had heard her mother say this or something like it many times before. Mame was terrified of fire.
Be careful of fire. Know when to use it and when to stay cold, she would often say.
It was an accident, Essie snapped. She wanted to be outside, catching more of the warriors' discussion. Her mother reached over and yanked her ear.
Who are you talking to that way? She hissed. Think before you act.
Think before you speak.
Essie apologized to her mother, and Mame, who had never been able to stay mad at Essie for longer than a few seconds, kissed the top of her head as the men's cries grew louder and louder. Everyone in the village knew the story. Essie had her father tell it to her every night for a whole month. She would lie with her head in his lap, listening as he spoke of how the men stole out from the northern village on the evening of the rallying cry. Their plan was thin: overtake the town and steal whatever had been stolen. Essie's father told her of how he led the group through the forest until they came upon the circle of warriors protecting the newly acquired goods. Her father and his warriors hid in the trees. Their feet moved with the lightness of leaves on the forest ground. When they came upon the warriors of the northern village, they fought bravely, but it was of no use. Essie's father and many others were captured and packed into huts that had been converted into a prison camp. It was Kwaku Ajay and his few followers who had had the foresight to wait in the forest until after the eager warriors had rushed in. They found the guns that the northerners were hiding and loaded them quickly and quietly before moving in to where their fellow men were being held captive. Though there were only a few of them, Kwaku Ajay and his men were able to hold off the warriors with the stories they told of the many men they had waiting behind them. Kwaku Ajay said that if this mission failed, there would be one raid every night until the end of time. If it isn't the West, it will be the whites, he reasoned, darkness glinting from the gap between his front teeth. The northerners felt they had no choice but to give in. They released Essie's father and the others, who parted with five of the stolen guns. The men returned to their village in silence, Essie's father consumed by his embarrassment. When they reached the edge of their village, he stopped Kwaku Ajay, got down on both of his knees, and bowed his head before him. I am sorry, my brother. I will never again rush into a fight when it is possible to reason. It takes a big man to admit his folly, Kwaku Ajay said, and they all continued into the village, the contrite and newly christened big man leading the way. This was the big man who returned to Essie, the one she knew as she grew older, slow to anger, rational, and still the strongest and bravest warrior of them all. By the time Essie turned 12, their small village had won more than 55 wars under Big Man's leadership. The spoils of these wars could be seen as the warriors carried them back, shimmering gold and colorful textiles in large tan sacks, captives in iron cages. It was the prisoners that fascinated Essie the most, for after each capture, they would be put on display in the center of the village square. Anyone could walk by and stare at them, mostly young, virile warriors, though sometimes women and their children. Some of these prisoners would be taken by the villagers as slaves, houseboys and housegirls, cooks and cleaners. But soon there would be too many to keep, and the overflow would have to be dealt with. "Mama, what happens to all the prisoners after they leave here?" Essie asked Mammy as they passed by the square one afternoon, a roped goat, their dinner, trailing behind them.
"That's boys' talk, Essie. You don't need to think about it," her mother replied, shifting her eyes. For as long as Essie could remember, and perhaps even before, Mammy had refused to choose her own housegirl or houseboy from among the prisoners who were paraded through the village each month. But because there were now so many prisoners, Big Man had started to insist. "A house girl could help you with the cooking," he said. "Essie helps me with my cooking." "But Essie is my daughter, not some common girl to be ordered about." Essie smiled. She loved her mother, but she knew how lucky Mame was to have gotten a husband like Big Man when she had no family, no background to speak of. Big Man had saved Mame somehow, from what wretchedness Essie did not know. She knew only that her mother would do almost anything for her father. "All right," she said. "Essie and I will choose a girl tomorrow." And so they chose a girl and decided to call her Abra Noma, Little Dove. The girl had the darkest skin Essie had ever seen. She kept her eyes low, and though her tree was passable, she rarely spoke it. She didn't know her age, but Essie guessed Abra Noma was not much older than she was. At first, Abra Noma was horrible at the chores. She spilled oil. She didn't sweep under things. She didn't have good stories for the children.
"She's useless," Mame said to Big Man. "We have to take her back."
They were all outside, basking under the warm midday sun. Big Man tilted his head back and let out a laugh that rumbled like thunder in the rainy season.
"Take her back where?"
"Odo, there's only one way to train a slave."
He turned to Essie, who was trying to climb a palm tree, the way she'd seen the other kids do it, but her arms were too small to reach around. "Essie, go and get me my switch." The switch in question was made from two reeds tied together. It was older than Essie's paternal grandfather, having been passed down from generation to generation. Big Man had never beaten Essie with it, but she had seen him beat his sons. She'd heard the way it whistled when it snapped back off of flesh. Essie moved to enter the compound, but Mame stopped her.
"No," she said.
Big Man raised his hand to his wife, anger flashing quickly through his eyes like steam from cold water hitting a hot pan.
"No?"
Mame stammered. I just think that I should be the one to do it." Big Man lowered his hand. He stared at her carefully for a while longer, and Essie tried to read the look that passed between them.
"So be it," Big Man said. "But tomorrow I will bring her out here. She will carry water from this yard to that tree there, and if even so much as a drop falls, then I will take care of it. Do you hear me?"
Mame nodded, and Big Man shook his head. He had always told anyone who would listen that he had spoiled his third wife, seduced by her beautiful face and softened by her sad eyes. Mame and Essie went into their hut and found Abunoma curled up on a bamboo cut, living up to her name of a little bird. Mame woke her and had her stand before them. She pulled out a switch that Big Man had given her, a switch she had never used. She then looked at Essie with tears in her eyes. "Please, leave us." Essie left the hut and for minutes after could hear the sound of the switch and the harmonizing pitch of two separate cries. The next day, Big Man called everyone in his compound out to see if Abunoma could carry a bucket of water on her head from the yard to the tree without spilling a drop. Essie and her whole family, her four stepmothers and nine half-siblings, scattered around their large yard, waiting for the girl to first fetch water from the stream into a large black bucket. From there, Big Man had her stand before all of them and bow before starting the journey to the tree. He would walk beside her to be certain there was no error. Essie could see Little Dove shaking as she lifted the bucket onto her head. Mame clutched Essie against her chest and smiled at the girl when she bowed at them. But the look Abunoma returned was fearful, and then vacant. When the bucket touched her head, the family began to jeer. "She'll never make it," Ama, Big Man's first wife, said. "Watch. She will spill it all and drown herself in the process," Kojo, the eldest son, said. Little Dove took her first step, and Essie let out the breath she had been holding. She herself had never been able to carry so much as a single plank of wood on her head, but she had watched her mother carry a perfectly round coconut, without it ever rolling off, steady as a second head. "Where did you learn to do that?" Essie had asked Mame then, and the woman replied, "You can learn anything when you have to learn it. You could learn to fly if it meant you would live another day." Abunoma steadied her legs and kept walking, her head facing forward. Big Man walked beside her, whispering insults in her ear. She reached the tree at the forest's edge and pivoted, making her way back to the audience that awaited her. By the time she got close enough that Essie could make out her features again, there was sweat dripping off the ledge of her nose and her eyes were brimming with tears. Even the bucket on her head seemed to be crying, condensation working its way down the outside of it. As she lifted the bucket off of her head, she started to smile triumphantly. Maybe it was a small gust of wind, maybe an insect looking for a bath, or maybe the dove's hand slipped. But before the bucket reached the ground, two drops sloshed out. Essie looked at Mame, who had turned her sad, pleading eyes to Big Man. But by that point, the rest of the family was already shouting for punishment. Kojo began to lead them into a song. "The dove has failed, oh, what to do? Make her to suffer, or you'll fail too." Big Man reached for his switch, and soon the song gained its accompaniment, the percussion of reed to flesh, the woodwind of reed to air. This time, Abunoma did not cry. "If he didn't beat her, everyone would think he was weak," Essie said. After the event, Mame had been inconsolable, crying to Essie that Big Man should not have beaten Little Dove for so small a mistake. Essie was licking soup off of her fingers, her lips stained orange. Her mother had taken Abunoma into their hut and made a salve for her wounds, and now the girl lay on a cot, sleeping. "Weak, eh?" Mame said. She glared at her daughter with malice that Essie had never before seen. "Yes," Essie whispered. that I should live to hear my own daughter speak like this. You want to know what weakness is? Weakness is treating someone as though they belong to you. Strength is knowing that everyone belongs to themselves. Essie was hurt. She had only said what anyone else in her village would have said. And for this, Mammy yelled at her. Essie wanted to cry, to hug her mother, something. But Mammy left the room then to finish the chores that Abronoma could not perform that night. Just as she left, Little Dove began to stir. Essie fetched her water and helped tilt her head back so that she could drink it. The wounds on her back were still fresh, and the salve that Mammy had made stank of the forest. Essie wiped the corners of Abronoma's lips with her fingers, but the girl pushed her away. "Leave me," she said. "I'm sorry for what happened. He is a good man." Abronoma spit onto the clay in front of her. "Your father is a big man, eh?" she asked, and Essie nodded, proud, despite what she had just seen her father do. The dove let out a mirthless laugh. "My father, too, is big man. And now look at what I am. Look at what your mother was." "What my mother was?" Little Dove's eyes shot toward Essie. "You don't know?" Essie, who had not spent more than an hour away from her mother's sight in her life, couldn't imagine any secrets. She knew the feel of her and the smell of her. She knew how many colors were in her irises, and she knew each crooked tooth. Essie looked at Abronoma, but Abronoma shook her head and continued her laugh. "Your mother was once a slave for a Fonti family. She was raped by her master, because he too was a big man, and big men can do what they please, lest they appear weak, eh?" Essie looked away, and Abronoma continued in a whisper, "You are not your mother's first daughter. There was one before you, and in my village, we have a saying about separated sisters. They are like a woman and her reflection, doomed to stay on opposite sides of the pond." Essie wanted to hear more, but there was no time to ask the dove. Mammy came back into the room and saw the two girls sitting beside each other. "Essie, come here and let Abronoma sleep. Tomorrow you will wake up early and help me clean." Essie left Abronoma to her rest. She looked at her mother. The way her shoulders always seemed to droop, the way her eyes were always shifting. Suddenly, Essie was filled with a horrible shame. She remembered the first time she'd seen an elder spit on the captives in the town square. The man had said, "Northerners, they are not even people. They are the dirt that begs for spit." Essie was 5 years old then. His words had felt like a lesson. And the next time she passed, she timidly gathered her own spit and launched it at a little boy who stood huddled with his mother. The boy had cried out, speaking a language that Essie didn't understand. And Essie had felt bad, not for having spit, but for knowing how angry her mother would have been to see her do it. Now all Essie could picture was her own mother behind the dull metal of the cages. Her own mother, huddled with a sister she would never know. In the months that followed, Essie tried to befriend Abronoma. Her heart had started to ache for the little bird who had now perfected her role as housegirl. Since the beating, no crumb was dropped, no water spilled. In the evenings, after Abronoma's work was done, Essie would try to coax more information from her about her mother's past. "I don't know any more," Abronoma said,
taking the bundle of palm branches to sweep the floor, or straining used oil through leaves.
"Don't worry me," she screamed once she'd reached the height of her annoyance.
Still, Essie tried to make amends.
"What can I do?" she asked. "What can I do?"
After weeks of asking, Essie finally received an answer.
"Send word to my father," Abunoma said. "Tell him where I am, and there will be no bad blood between us."
That night, Essie couldn't sleep. She wanted to make peace with Abunoma, but if her father knew what she had been asked to do, surely there would be war in her hut. She could hear her father now, yelling at Mame, telling her that she was raising Essie to be a small woman, weak. On the floor of her hut, Essie turned and turned and turned, until finally her mother hushed her.
"Please," Mame said, "I'm tired."
And all Essie could see behind her closed eyelids was her mother as housegirl. Essie decided then that she would send the message. Early, early, early the next morning, she went to the messenger man who lived on the edge of the village. He listened to her words and the words of others before setting out into the forest every week. Those words would be carried from village to village, messenger man to messenger man. Who knew if Essie's message would ever reach Abunoma's father? It could be dropped or forgotten, altered or lost, but at the very least, Essie could say that she had done it. When she got back, Abunoma was the only person yet awake. Essie told her what she had done that morning, and the girl clapped her hands together and then gathered Essie into her small arms, squeezing until Essie's breath caught. "All is forgotten?" Essie asked, once the dove had released her.
"Everything is equal," Abunoma said, and relief rushed through Essie's body like blood. It filled her to the brim and left her fingers shaking. She hugged Abunoma back, and as the girl's bodies relaxed in her arms, Essie let herself imagine that the body she was hugging was her sister's.
Months went by, and little Dove grew excited. In the evening she could be found pacing the grounds and muttering to herself before sleep,
my father is coming.
Big Man heard her mutterings and told everyone to beware of her, for she might be a witch. Essie would watch her carefully for signs, but every day it was the same thing.
My father is coming. I know it. He is coming.
Finally, Big Man promised to slap the words out of the dove if she continued, and so she stopped, and the family soon forgot. Everyone went along as usual. Essie's village had never been challenged in Essie's lifetime. All fighting was done away from home. Big Man and the other warriors would go into nearby villages, pillaging the land, sometimes setting the grass on fire so that people from three villages over could see the smoke and know the warriors had come. But this time, things were different. It began while the family was sleeping. It was Big Man's night in Mame's hut, so Essie had to sleep on the ground in the corner. When she heard the soft moaning, the quickened breath, she turned to face the wall of the hut. Once, just once, she had watched them where they lay, the darkness helping to cover her curiosity. Her father was hovering over her mother's body, moving softly at first, and then with more force. She couldn't see much, but it was the sounds that had interested her. The sounds her parents made together, sounds that walked a thin line between pleasure and pain. Essie both wanted and was afraid to want, so she never watched again. That night, once everyone in the hut had fallen asleep, the call went out. Everyone in the village had grown up knowing what each sound signified. Two long moans meant the enemy was miles off yet. Three quick shouts meant they were upon them. Hearing the three, Big Man jumped from the bed and grabbed the machete he stored under each of his wives' cots. "You take Essie and go into the woods," he screamed at Mame before running from the hut with little time to cover his nakedness. Essie did what her father had taught her, grabbing the small knife that her mother used to slice plantains and tucking it into the cloth of her skirt. Mame sat at the edge of her cot. "Come on," Essie said, but her mother didn't move. Essie rushed to the bed and shook her, but she still didn't move.
"I can't do it again," she whispered.
"Do what again?" Essie asked, but she was hardly listening. Adrenaline was coursing through her so urgently that her hands trembled. Was this because of the message she had sent?
"I can't do it again," her mother whispered. "No more woods. No more fire."
She was rocking back and forth and cradling the fat flap of her stomach in her arms as though it were a child. Abronama came in from the slave quarters, a laugh echoing through the hut.
"My father is here," she said, dancing this way and that. "I told you he would come to find me, and he has come."
The girl scurried away, and Essie didn't know what would become of her. Outside, people were screaming and running. Children were crying. Essie's mother grabbed Essie's hand and dropped something into it. It was a black stone, glimmering with gold, smooth, as if it had been scrubbed carefully for years to preserve its perfect surface.
"I have been keeping this for you," Mame said. "I wanted to give it to you on your wedding day. I left one like this for your sister. I left it with Baba after I set the fire."
"My sister?" Essie asked. So what Abanoma said was true. Mame babbled nonsense words, words she had never spoken before. Sister, Baba, fire, sister, Baba, fire. Essie wanted to ask more questions, but the noise outside was growing louder and her mother's eyes were growing blank, emptying somehow of something. Essie stared at her mother then, and it was as though she was seeing her for the first time. Mame was not a whole woman. There were large swaths of her spirit missing, and no matter how much she loved Essie, and no matter how much Essie loved her, they both knew in that moment that love could never return what Mame had lost. And Essie knew, too, that her mother would die rather than run into the woods ever again. Die before capture. Die, even if it meant that in her dying, Essie would inherit that unspeakable sense of loss, learn what it meant to be unwhole.
"You go," Mame said, as Essie tugged at her arms, tried to move her legs.
"Go," she repeated. Essie stopped and tucked the black stone into her wrapper. She hugged her mother, took the knife from her skirt, put it in her mother's hand, and ran. She reached the woods quickly and found a palm tree that her arms could manage. She had been practicing, not knowing that it was for this. She wrapped her arms around the trunk, hugging it while using her legs to push her up, up, as far as she could go. The moon was full, as large as the rock of terror that was sitting in Essie's gut. What had she ever known of terror? Time passed and passed. Essie felt like her arms were encircling fire instead of the tree, so badly were they burning. The dark shadows of the leaves on the ground had started to look menacing. Soon, the sound of screaming people falling from the trees like plucked fruit could be heard all around her, and then a warrior was at the bottom of her tree. His language was unfamiliar, but she knew enough to know what came next. He threw a rock at her, then another, then another.
The fourth rock slammed into her side, but still she held on. The fifth hit the lattice of her clasped fingers. Her arms came undone, and she fell to the ground. She was tied to the others, how many she didn't know. She didn't see anyone from her compound, not her stepmothers or half-siblings, not her mother. The rope around her wrists held her palms out in supplication. Essie studied the lines on those palms. They led nowhere. She had never felt so hopeless in her life. Everyone walked. Essie had walked for miles with her father before, and so she thought that she could take it. And indeed, the first few days were not so bad. But by the tenth, the calluses on Essie's feet split open, and blood seeped out, painting the leaves she left behind. Ahead of her, the bloody leaves of others. So many were crying that it was difficult to hear when the warriors spoke, but she wouldn't have understood them anyway. When she could, she checked to see if the stone her mother had given her was still safely tucked in her wrapper. She didn't know how long they would be allowed to keep their clothes. The leaves on the forest ground were so damp with blood and sweat and dew that the child in front of Essie slipped on them. One of the warriors caught him, helped him to stand up, and the little boy thanked him. "Why should he thank him? They are going to eat us all," the woman behind Essie said. Essie had to strain to hear through the haze of tears and buzz of insects that surrounded them. "Who will eat us?" Essie asked. "The white men." "That is what my sister says. She says the white men buy us from these soldiers, and then they cook us up like goats in soup." "No!" Essie cried. And one of the soldiers was quick to run up to her and poke her side with a stick. Once he left, her flank throbbing, Essie pictured the goats that walked freely around her village. Then she pictured herself capturing one, the way she roped its legs and laid its body down, the way she slit its neck. Was this how the white men would kill her? She shuddered. "What's your name?" Essie asked. "They call me Tansy. They call me Essie." And like that, the two became friends. They walked all day. The sores on Essie's feet had no time to heal. So soon were they reopened. At times, the warriors would leave them tied to trees in the forest so that they could go ahead and survey the people of new villages. At times, more people from those villages would be taken and added to the rest of them. The rope around Essie's wrists had started to burn. A strange burn, like nothing she had ever felt before. Like cool fire, the scratch of salty wind. And soon, the smell of that wind greeted Essie's nose, and she knew from stories she had heard that they were nearing Fantiland. The traders slapped their legs with sticks, making them move faster. For almost half of that week, they walked both day and night. The ones who couldn't keep up were beaten with the sticks until suddenly, like magic, they could. Finally, once Essie's own legs had started to buckle, they reached the edge of some Fanti village. They were all packed into a dark and damp cellar, and Essie had time to count the group. 35. 35 people held together by rope. They had time to sleep, and when they awoke, they were given food. A strange porridge that Essie had never eaten before. She didn't like the taste of it, but she could sense that there would be nothing else for a long while. Soon men came into the room. Some were the warriors that Essie had seen before, but others were new. "So these are the slaves you have brought us," one of the men said in Fanti. It had been a long while since Essie had heard anyone speak that dialect, but she could understand him clearly. "Let us out!" the others tied to Essie began to shout.
now that they had an ear that could listen. Fanti and Ashanti, fellow Akans,